Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning. All of the regulars, the guests, as well as our radio audience. I want to start out by thanking all of you who participated in the elections on Tuesday. That goes for everyone who voted. And also, I see at least one candidate here, Sam Roberts. Congratulations, Sam, a state assemblyman. Re-elected. I would beg to differ, but okay. Unless you're announcing something that you're not going to do again. All right. Anyway, thank you all very much. As we know, the next order of business for President Obama and the administration is to deal with the fiscal cliff, as they call it. I like to call it the fiscal train wreck. That's what the Citizens League called it back several years ago in one of our studies. But one of the top items on the agenda, of course, is tax policy and tax reform. So how can you do that or have an opinion on it if you don't know what the tax policy is now? So I suggest that you join us next week when we will have David K. Johnston. He is a former New York Times reporter, Pulitzer Prize winner, author, and now an adjunct professor at SU. And the title of his talk is How Corporate Socialism is Devastating America. So there you have it. That's next week. This week, though, of course, we are very pleased to have members of the Ivory Tower panel. That is the WCNY TV show stars. David Rubin, our usual moderator and founder of the group, had planned to be here. But again, he is another victim of Superstorm Sandy because classes on campus were canceled last Tuesday, and David's 8 a.m. Class with the group of undergraduates was canceled. Of course, he didn't want to miss another Tuesday, Thursday class this week. So he Bob Spitzer very kindly agreed to moderate the panel. So I'm going to turn it over to Bob Spitzer and ask him to then introduce himself, mainly for the radio audience, so that they will hear everyone's voices at the start and know then when we get into comments and questions, as you know, and I know there are going to be a lot of questions. Please be patient with me and hold up your hand. I try to do things in order of how I see them, unless it means too much crisscrossing. I have a method, believe me. So again, thank you all, and take it away, Bob Spitzer.
Thank you, Sandy. David Rubin does send his apologies for not being here today. I'm a poor substitute. And I am Bob Spitzer. I'm the chair of the Political Science Department at SUNY Cortland. So Cortland, hoo-hoo, okay. There's one right there. We have at least one alum in the audience. Before we introduce the panel, let me say that the Ivory Tower Half Hour, which broadcasts every Friday night at 8 p.m. on WCNY, is in its 11th year. It is, according to Nielsen ratings, we have actual Nielsen points, we're the most highly watched local television program on any local channel in Central New York. I just report the news, I don't make it. It is a matter of great pride, especially because it was not a program that anybody expected to have such a following. So we're grateful, especially to those of you who watch the program. Let's take a minute and run down the panel. I'll just ask each person to give his or her name and affiliation.
I'm Tara Ross, and I'm a professor of history at Onondaga Community College.
I'm Bob Green. I'm a professor of history at Cazenovia College.
And I'm Lisa Dolak, a law professor at Syracuse University.
All right. Well, we want to get right to the elections, and we do also want to have time for discussion or questions. Let me just begin by making a few general points about the election on Tuesday, and then we'll have some discussion about particulars. As I say to my students, if you begin with the electoral map 4 years ago, 2008, and compare it to the results Tuesday night, it's a pretty close parallel. One state, Florida, is going to be conducting a recount, but Obama has about a 50,000 vote lead in Florida. It's pretty clear Florida will go to Obama when the recount is done. Assuming that to be the case, Obama will have 332 electoral votes in this election to 206 for Mitt Romney. If you take the states of Indiana and North Carolina, both of which went for Romney this time, those are the two states that went for Obama 4 years ago, and in the Electoral College, that's the difference between 2008 and 2012. It looks as though voter turnout was lower this year than it was 4 years ago, although Obama did well among key constituencies, and that was critical to his election, and we'll be talking about that. In the United States Senate, the balance before the election was 53 Democrats and 47 Republicans. It looks as though the Democrats actually have picked up a net gain of two seats, and the new United States Senate will be 55 Democrats and 45 Republicans. In the House of Representatives, there are still a number of races that are very close that haven't been called, and I'm not including the Central New York race in that category. So it's not clear, I think, as of this morning, what the actual net balance will be, but the Republicans clearly will continue to control the House of Representatives. And there have already been statements by chamber leaders from both the House and the Senate about anticipation of what they're going to be working on with Obama in a possible lame duck Congress later this month or next month, and then the new Congress starting in January. In the state Senate, I know there are two races that are still in doubt, but it seems clear that the Democrats will gain control of the state Senate here in New York when all is said and done. The Democrats have a large margin in the state assembly, and that doesn't change. And then, of course, we have the Central New York, the hotly contested Maffei-Burkle-Rossum race for the House of Representatives. The morning newspaper says that Maffei is up over Congresswoman Burkle by about 15,000 votes, and the Associated Press called that race for Maffei election night around 11:30 p.m., and it does not, it seems pretty clear that Maffei will be returning to Congress, and we can talk about that race too. Let's begin with the presidential race. We haven't designated particular responses from particular individuals, but we can begin with what particular item in your view shaped President Obama's victory last night among constituents, among weaknesses in the Romney campaign? How would you explain the outcome of the presidential race? Anything that seemed particularly important, Tara?
First and foremost, it has to do with the Democratic Party and President Obama's reelection campaign committee really getting to understand who their constituency was, what their constituents needed to hear in order to continue to support President Obama, and then really getting the ground troops out there and getting people out to vote. Because one of the big fears was that the president would not get the same sort of support that he received in 2008 because it was not the quote-unquote historic campaign that 2008 was. And the Democrats really did a very good job of really recognizing that they would have to sort of set the stage for winning the election early on. They did that back in the summer. They continued to organize. As it has been pointed out numerous places, that the president did not have to go through this long, drawn-out primary that Romney had to go through. So you didn't have as many of his warts out there, so to speak. But what that also allowed was it allowed the president's campaign committee to really focus on getting him reelected and getting all the people in place so that they could get to the public, get to his supporters, and make sure they came out and voted.
I agree with all of that. I'll add, from the Obama point of view, and then I want to talk about the state of the Republican Party right now. One of the numbers that I was flashing around a lot on air on Tuesday night, and the number that I think ended up being the magic number for victory, was the number 536 to 212. And that's not anything to do with the Electoral College. That's the number of Obama headquarters and Obama campaign headquarters vis-a-vis the number of Romney campaign headquarters, boots on the ground in the swing states. Obama had more people on the ground faster, and this was not something that just magically appeared after the first debate. These numbers were established back in August. And so the Romney campaign, which was bad from the start, and mishandled from the start, and mismanaged from the start, could not, when it got the magic gift of the first debate from Romney, who clearly beat Obama senseless in the first debate, they didn't have the people on the ground to take advantage of it. And they didn't have the presence in the swing states to be able to benefit from the unexpected victory of Romney in the first debate. And that was part of why the polls flatlined after that instead of continuing to creep up for Romney and bringing the race even closer. But I think something does have to be said about the Republican Party. And I said this a number of times over the past couple of days. The Republicans have to figure out how to nominate a real moderate if they are going to win on the national level. Not an individual who becomes a moderate in the first debate. That was so transparent that it even angered some Republicans. The party has been hijacked by the right wing. And what the Democrats have not allowed to happen is to have their party hijacked by the left wing. You have to be a moderate to win in the fall. You can't be a phony moderate to win in the fall. And as you see the 2016, I'll be the first one to bring up 2016 before we eat our breakfast. But as you see 2016 shaping up, you don't see any Republican moderates stepping forth. They're making the same mistake all over again.
How about Chris Christie?
You don't see any Republican moderates stepping forth.
How about Chris Christie?
I'll try this one more time.
Okay, that's okay.
Lisa?
I get it.
I mean, I think the big message that we've heard a lot about in the last 2 days, and it's undeniably true, it's not like we couldn't see it coming, it's that the Republicans refused, and some continue to refuse, remarkably to deny it, is the importance of demography. This was an election about divisions. This was white versus people of color, old versus young, rich versus poor, men versus women. And again, this is not far from rocket science in terms of the impact of demographics on the electorate and on the future of the Republican Party. I will just say, we can talk more about that. I'm sure everyone's heard so much about that in the last 2 days. I don't want to belabor it, but I actually, although I despair at the decrepit and sad, pathetic state of the Republican Party and can't believe my eyes when I continue to read, as I did just this morning in news accounts, that there are members of the party who still continue to not deny reality, I do think it's possible for a moderate to, and the first thing I'll say is that although the Democrats haven't allowed the left wing to take over their party lately, there was a time when the Democrats had to make the same recovery that the Republicans now have to make. So, and it wasn't that long ago.
They came back from Walter Mondale.
Right, exactly. So, and so parties can evolve and they can shift, and I believe that the Republicans can do it. And I do believe, but what it's going to take is it's going to take a Republican moderate who is willing to stand up to Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and call out, every time it happens, the irresponsible and extreme members of the party, and Romney had numerous opportunities to do that. I don't think that it would have made him look particularly any more authentic necessarily, because he just, I mean, over this entire lengthy election cycle has not looked authentic and at any phase, right? He didn't look like an authentic conservative, and then he didn't look like an authentic moderate.
How would any of you assess the impact or the future of the Tea Party within the Republican Party? Are they still in control? Do they double down? Do they modify strategy? Do others in the party challenge their preeminence?
Well, they never were in control. They were on such a far right wing of the Republican Party that they weren't in control except in the minds of the balkanized media, who in the world of Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity and others saw this as the future of the Republican Party. But in terms of the success of the Tea Party on the national level, Ryan couldn't even carry his home state. So I think that the role of the Tea Party is diminished in reality. But Lisa brings up a very important point. To drive ratings and to drive talk radio and to drive Fox TV and to drive other conservative media, there is going to be persistent in the Republican Party this back chatter that what we need now is a real, true believing conservative. And that's going to be out there. And what they don't understand or they refuse to accept or they're ignoring for ratings is that if they do, and this is regardless of philosophy and how you feel about it, if they do get that far right person, they're going to lose again. So somebody ought to put a cork on Fox because it's really hurting the chances of the Republican Party to win in a wonderful irony.
Well, you have to separate the question of the impact of the Tea Party and its influence via the media versus the impact of the Tea Party in the party. And I think while on a national level, the Tea Party probably doesn't have that much impact. If you look at the elections on the state and local level, the Tea Party did either hold its positions or it gained positions. So to say that the Tea Party won't have any more influence on the Republican Party, I think is inaccurate. Now, in terms of the Tea Party and its influence via the media, you're right. Somebody needs to, definitely clamp down on Fox News and certainly force them to be a little more honest and accurate in their reporting, because I think that did hurt the Republicans nationally. But to assume that the Tea Party won't have any influence on the state and local level, I think is inaccurate.
And before somebody jumps and says, why don't you saying clamp down on MSNBC? What MSNBC and the liberal wing of the media has not done is forced the Democratic Party so far to the left that they can't recover. In fact, they've done the exact opposite. They have been part of the movement of bringing Obama and his people more to the center after an incredibly bloody and divisive primary with Hillary Clinton. So it's not philosophical, it's strategic in terms of what the media is doing. And in terms of them winning on the local level, there's going to be pockets of conservative, pockets of liberal, and pockets of Tea Party victory, but I don't see it adding up to the Tea Party being in control of anything except some mythological view of how important they are.
I'd like to make two points and then solicit your comments. One is to make the point that the pollsters were right in this election. The pollsters took a beating to some degree, partly because people don't like to hear results that are at odds with their dispositions, with their predispositions. In particular, Nate Silver of 538.com, he was right, and the pollsters, by and large, were correct in the national trends, in the statewide outcomes, and I think it's important to note that. That doesn't mean that pollsters will never make a mistake or that there isn't junk polling. There certainly is. There's plenty of it. But the mainline pollsters, the ones that receive the national attention that's appropriate, called this race, and I think they deserve credit for that. It's important not to forget that. But secondly, I would offer the argument that this election really winds up being a continuity election. And when you think about the players that are going to be sitting down at the table after January 1, after the new office holders take the oath of office and after the president is sworn in a second time, look who's there. It's the Senate controlled by the Democrats that don't have a filibuster-proof majority. It's the Republicans in control in the House, John Boehner. It's President Obama. Why should anything be different on January 1 as opposed to 2012 or before?
Well,
will anything be different?
I don't.
Glad you framed it that way.
I don't think so. But there is the possibility. Why should the one thing that has changed is that the president no longer has to run for re-election.
Right.
Thank heavens. I would have a one-term president in this country for everybody, because I think that we lose so much as a country, because I think that much of what led to what was on many issues Obama's absence from the debate or discussion, or his smallness in terms of the things that he undertook, is because he was running for re-election the entire 4 years. I'm hoping that finally freed from the need to run for re-election, that we will get the president. We will get leadership in the president. I don't think that every era requires a strong leader in the presidency. I think this particular era and the challenges that the country faces do. And so I'm hoping that the president, now freed from this, will actually lead. And part of that leading is going to mean working with Congress. And I'm not just talking about work crossing the aisle to work with Republicans. I'm talking about actually engaging with Congress, going to Capitol Hill, or having the members of Congress come to talk to him, which is something that he has not done.
Well, you know I disagree with you on the one-term presidency. The debate that went on in Philadelphia in 1787 between Madison and Hamilton decided that we weren't going to have a one-term king. And we can have as many terms, two terms for the president. All we got to do is reelect him. In terms of this being a continuity election, Bob, you're exactly right in terms of the setup on the national scene. But one area where that might tweak the continuity is within the president's staff and within the president's cabinet. We know that the cabinet's in flux. Secretary of State Clinton has stepped down or said she's stepping down, and there's no indication that she's going to reverse that. So there's going to be a big ticket player for people who want the horse race, trying to figure out who the next Secretary of State's going to be. But if I was Obama, and predicting what President Obama does is a useless task because he has confounded prognosticators on a number of occasions, I'd fire my entire staff of people who deal with Capitol Hill. And there's about 45 people working within the executive office of the president who are responsible for relationships with Capitol Hill, and whoever they are, they stink. Whoever they are, they're absolutely terrible, and they did not do Obama well through Obamacare. They didn't do it well through the issue of immigration, and he should clean house there. He probably won't, because it would be just like hanging a lantern on the problem of his relationship with John Boehner. But that would be what I would do, and let the cabinet sit still, because essentially the cabinet doesn't do anything anyway.
Other comments? No? Do we have any particular observations about the congressional races? Maybe we should jump directly to Central New York, to the race that's received so much attention. Roughly $8 million was spent on the campaign in the congressional race here in the 24th Congressional District. It's a huge amount of money. It's a race that received national attention. It was a rematch. And of course, it was a close election 2 years ago when Anne-Marie Berkel won with a little over 600 votes. And she's lost the race now, it seems. Why the turnaround after only 2 years?
Well, you know, I first and foremost, anyone who watched the show last Friday knows that I didn't think this would be the result. I'm a little confounded by it. But one of the things that I do think is perhaps Maffei was more successful than I thought he would be with his ads concerning Berkel's support for Aiken's legislation. Painting her as being a part of the Tea Party, unwilling to really see beyond the interests of the Tea Party. And apparently he was much more successful than I thought he was at that. Also, Rossum didn't hurt him as much as I thought she might hurt him. And that also was a bit of a surprise, although I don't think some people thought she would do as well as she did. But she didn't hurt him that much. She seems to have actually hurt Berkel more. So those are the only two comments I would have.
That is what has to be explained, is why Rossum did not pull from Dan Maffei as expected. One of the things that we saw in the newsroom on election night was that there was a slight increase in turnout in the election because it was so close. And so there were actual Green Party supporters coming out for Rossum instead of disaffected Democrats. And so while she polled at 8.5%, and she may, with absentee ballots, get even higher before this is done, it wasn't at the expense of any one candidate. It's actually a testament to Green Party organization and Green Party membership that there have been, according to the polls, Greens out there who just simply haven't voted in the past and came out and voted for a candidate where their vote would actually show some amount of support. But the other thing that we were seeing in the newsroom, because, of course, everybody was trying to explain this, I'm just glad this race is over. This is the nastiest, bloodiest race between two individuals that I've seen in a long time. It's polarizing, and it's not good for Central New York. It was terrible. But the bump for Maffei came with the Clinton visit. And somebody who Dan Maffei should be you know, patting on the back, taking that visit and cutting that ad, that very final ad that you saw with Maffei standing next to Clinton in the, at the podium, and Maffei just kind of standing there smiling, or, well, Maffei just kind of standing there, all right? And Clinton essentially saying, you must vote for Dan Maffei. They got the perfect soundbite out of that visit for an advertisement. And that, there were people in the newsroom who said that's at least 1% for Dan Maffei. And the other one was that it was just not as close in Wayne County as it was 2 years ago. Burkle won there, but not by the margin that she did before.
Which is probably attributable to an enthusiasm lag, a turnout issue, in other words, in Wayne County.
It was so close and so nasty that the people just had a visceral reaction against this race.
Well, let me suggest a couple things about this race. First, let's remember that it's a new district, slightly modified from the district 2 years ago, and it's slightly more Democratic in its makeup. So there was maybe a little bit of an advantage for a Democratic candidate in the new 24th district. Secondly, there was vastly increased turnout over 2 years ago. You always have lower voter turnout in a midterm congressional year, and you have a turnout increase of 50%, 70%, or even more, comparing a midterm year to a presidential year, and that tends to, other things being equal, provide an advantage to a Democratic candidate, let's say in a race here in central New York. As for the, very sort of negative and nasty tone, it certainly was a very sharp-elbowed race, but not that unusual in American politics. There have certainly been plenty of difficult and nasty campaigns in the contemporary era. In the 19th century, political campaigns were far more vicious than they are in the modern era. I would attribute the negative campaign in central New York to two fairly specific things. One is how close the race was. There wasn't much public polling. There were a couple of Siena polls,
right.
And both of them showed it a dead heat. Maybe internal polling that the candidates were doing showed other numbers. I don't know about that. But clearly, it was going to be a close race. And secondly, there was an ideological chasm between the two candidates. I mean, they were really not just partly different, but very, very different, ideologically speaking. And the great ideological gap between the two certainly offered voters a clear choice. You couldn't have gone to the polls on Tuesday and said to yourself, well, there's not really much difference between these two candidates. It's a perennial...
Three
candidates, including the Green candidate. And while one would naturally assume that the Green Party candidate would tend to draw votes from the Democrat on the ideological spectrum, it may well have been the case. I mean, we don't know. It would be a great study if anybody did it. To see where Rossum's votes came from. And Bob suggests some of them could have been activated, people who might not have otherwise voted at all, and that may well be the case. Some people may also have voted for her as a protest vote, not because they were ideologically closest to Rossum, but as a way of saying that they were unhappy with the campaigns of both of the other candidates. In any case, I think it's consistent with a larger trend of New York State being a blue state and becoming a more blue state over time.
That's a good point. Remember what Rossum's last campaign stop was. It was a protest.
What was that?
She was out, she was protesting the drones, right? Yeah, there was film that we used of her at 6 o'clock, and she was out with individuals protesting the drones. And there were people in the background at this protest. She had her sign protesting the drones. And then in the background, people were raising the Green Party signs. And so it was definitely a combination of ideological protest and staged campaign event. And there were people in the newsroom who said, that's a really good last campaign stop. And someone who will remain nameless says, okay, there's another 1,000 votes. So, you know, all these things are going to go into play. Of all the candidates in the race, including Congressman-elect Maffei, I think the one with the brightest political future is Ursula Rossum.
Well, let me, we don't want to consume the entire time with solely our discussion. Let me just turn to a somewhat different topic. There's always discussion of media coverage of a political campaign. And let's turn to that subject. I'd be interested in hearing each of the panelists offer their thoughts on how they would assess media coverage, either some specific aspect of it or the more global nature of how the media covered this presidential campaign?
It seemed to me to be primarily focused on the candidates, on the atmospherics, you know, the gaffes, the things that candidates said that were funny or clever or cute and not particularly devoted to issues. I think if you were interested in educating yourself about issues, you had to go yourself and seek out the information. It wasn't pushed to you via the cable or broadcast news sources. You could find it on the internet, although there's a risk on the internet too, because as the phrase has been used by many others, the internet is so balkanized that it's hard to find a truly objective or neutral or website. A lot of what people spend their time reading on the internet is already slanted in one view or one direction or the other, and so you end up in an echo chamber if you're not careful on the internet.
One of the things that someone commented from the Obama campaign, they were commenting about the media coverage, and they mentioned that they felt like the media had focused way too much on personality traits, and it was all about personalities and how people behaved and what they looked like, etc. And one of the things that I found very interesting throughout this entire coverage is it was not just about the personalities of the candidates, it was also about the personalities of the media themselves. Many times when you listen to the commentators, it was as much them posturing as public figures, them trying to show, you know, how much more knowledgeable they were or how much more interesting their comment was, often not listening to one another. And so I thought that that really made this campaign, and it's continually gotten worse each campaign, I thought that made it so much harder for the public to really get a good sense of the policies or plans of the various candidates. One of the issues I had throughout the entire campaign was that very few media people, whatever channel you listen to, really held the candidates to what is your platform, what are your plans for the future, whether it was President Obama, whether it was former Governor Romney, Paul Ryan. I think the closest you came was Biden, simply because of Biden's experience, and he just sort of puts it out there and lets you deal with it. But as a whole, none of the media personalities really held the candidates to, okay, I want to hear a specific plan and back that plan up with facts, figures, etc. That very rarely happened. And it was very frustrating. And Lisa's right, you really had to go search out the information if you really wanted to get some real sense of where these candidates were going to lead us.
See, every 4 years we say the same thing about the media. The media concentrates on personality. The media does this, the media does that. And because there's so much money involved, absolutely no steps are taken to change it. I personally believe that the only media outlet that understood this election and reported on it fairly was us. But that's neither here nor there. I'll add on to what my colleagues say. First of all, the debates are a joke. And when you're talking media, the debates are a staged media event. And until we actually, I felt that the second presidential debate, where it looked like they were going to beat each other's brains out, was closer to what we want to have in a debate format, where there's actual, honest, sometimes angry, and emotional give and take. But that takes really a very special type of moderator. And while Jim Lehrer was terrible, I submit to you that the other two weren't much better. And until we get that format fixed, the debates are going to continue to be a joke. And second, in terms of the media, thanks to Citizens United, the worst decision made by the Supreme Court since World War II, we're not going to be able to take the flood of money out and until we get a system where the campaign ads are not keeping local media alive by putting the money in there. We're just going to be inundated with these campaign ads, and we're going to suffer with them as a result. I'm glad to see them go away. You're glad to see them go away, but that's an indictment of the system.
I'd like to make a point specifically about the debates. For their limitations, I think the debates are good. any opportunity to put the two candidates for president on a single stage at the same time, regardless of the format, I think is good. Again, noting their limitations, remember though, the debates and the debate formats are controlled by the political parties, not by the media. If the media was able to structure the debate format, it would surely have been very different from what we saw. But to me, media coverage was in a way symbolized by the behavior of the moderators of the first two debates. Jim Lehrer, who moderated the first debate, was criticized for being too passive, too vague, not offering very good questions. I think his questions, by and large, were terrible. It's as though he just didn't do his homework. Mm-hmm. And he didn't do effective follow-up. And he was roundly criticized for that, and I thought he had it coming, frankly. In the second debate, Candy Crowley was the moderator, and she attempted to assert a greater degree of control and not let the candidates just sort of roll over her, and I thought that was the right thing. And we actually had a very pointed discussion in one of my classes yesterday talking about this, where the critical moment when Candy Crowley interjected that a comment made by Romney was incorrect, when Romney said that Obama, the day after the attacks in Benghazi when Ambassador Stevens was killed and three other Americans were killed, that Obama gave a speech from the Rose Garden at the White House referring to them as acts of terror. And Romney was saying, well, no, you didn't refer to it as acts of terror or as a terrorist act until 14 days later. And Candy Crowley pipes up and says, well, in fact, President Obama was correct. In fact, she had been present at the Rose Garden speech the day after and reported on it, so she knew that to be the case. And several of my students were angry that she was improperly engaging in fact-checking. And the argument of one of my students was that no, fact-checking should occur after the event itself. And of course, there was fact-checking, and I think it was one bright spot of the campaign generally that reporters were engaging in sort of fact-checking activities. But it was an interesting interchange in my class, and it's a debate that has also been held around the country.
Well, Lehrer has, of course, had his feet put right to the fire, and people calling for his complete retirement as a result of this.
But he came out of retirement to do this, remember?
But he's defended himself in a way that respects the point of view of your students. He said, "I did exactly what a moderator should do. Nothing. I should just simply sit there and let them go at it and keep time." And in debate format, I mean, if you were schooled in debate format back in the day, that's what a moderator did. And what Crowley did was, quote unquote, out of line, but it's the shape of the new media with the moderator as personality and the moderator as celebrity. They all had their own little web presence because they'd been chosen to moderate these events, and they affected it.
Okay. We would like to leave time for discussion and comments. I'm sure many of you have thoughts on the election, so why don't we do that?
We're ready to go. We have, let me ask a question while I make my way over to Ed. Bob Green mentioned the super PACs and the effect of all of the money rolling in on the media. Aside from that, do we see the Citizens United affect in the outcome of the election? I think I read someplace that Romney's campaign got something like 3.5 times as much as Obama's campaign from super PACs, but I don't know what that means. I don't know which super PAC.
The entirety of this presidential campaign cost more than the gross national product of four Latin American countries. We won't know until post-January 1, when all of the figures have to be released, the exact breakdown of where each candidate got what. But certainly everybody is jumping to say, well, Romney got the lion's share of all of this. And if that's true, Romney lost.
Well, part of it was where that money went.
Right.
Romney received the bulk of the unaffiliated campaign spending from super PACs and what are called social welfare groups. Karl Rove's group alone raised and spent around $200 million. On behalf of Romney. But a lot of that was poured into TV money, which frankly wasn't as effective as, Bob Green's point, as boots on the ground.
Yeah. That's a perfect lead into my question. You referred to the boots on the ground operation for Obama, particularly in the contested states. I guess my question goes more toward coattails even though it's a 50-50 type race on the presidential side, what kind of impact do you see, or was there an impact, whether it's a Maffei race or other congressional or U.S. Senate races across the country, from the focus on field organization that was seemed to be more in the Democratic Party this time than the Republicans?
I heard on election night several people who were interviewed at both Democratic and Republican Party headquarters say that Dan Maffei benefited, for one example, Dan Maffei benefited from Obama's organization in New York State, which for a gift state was sizable, but also from the point of view of when Clinton came here, he brought his whole organization with him too. I think the issue of coattails is going to be large. If you went and you took this electoral map, and if you can see it, just forget that Florida is pink here because Florida is still in play. But if you put the House races over the red and the House races over the blue, I think that you would find a remarkable amount of symmetry. And where there's not symmetry, I'll bet you a nickel that it's to the negative for the Republicans, that there that Republicans were hurt in House races, particularly where there wasn't an incumbent present because Romney didn't have boots on the ground. Can I add one thing real quick? It's always, this is shameless, but when you get an honorable, thoughtful politician who makes an appearance, it's always good to see Bill Kinney in the crowd. And he's in the back here. It is always good to see Bill Kinney.
One group talking about breakdown of cohorts that you haven't talked about are independents. I was very impressed watching the election with, admittedly, CNN, and the number of times they broke down the registered voter group in any one area, even counties, there was a strong presence, almost 30% of independents. Would you care to comment on that?
There are two ways to think about independent voters in the United States. If you compare the number of Americans who identify themselves as independents, it's larger than the number who identify themselves as Republicans or Democrats. I mean, there are a lot of Americans for whom saying that they are independent is a point of pride. You know, I vote for the person, not the party. But their behavior belies their independence. The large majority of people who say they are independents, if you burrow into that number and ask the independents, well, do you lean a little bit to the Republican side or do you lean a little bit to the Democratic side? Most of them fall into one of those two categories. And in fact, it turns out that those leaners actually are loyal and exhibit a high degree of loyalty to those respective political parties when they actually vote. So when you factor them out, the percentage of true independents is really quite small. And in fact, one of the sort of important stories of this election was the fact that over 90% of Americans had decided how they were going to vote 12 months ago. Right. Okay. In other words, the mold was cast in this election a year ago. Now, that is not an unusual phenomenon. This was something that was actually discovered in a landmark study 70 years ago in a study of voters of Erie County, Ohio, believe it or not. But it's notable in this election for all of the fury and all of the money that the vast majority of voters had really already made up their minds, including the majority of those who identify themselves as independents. And that's why you saw so little movement in the polls throughout really the trajectory of the summer and the fall.
The other point that sometimes gets lost is that there are many people who are fiscally conservative and socially moderate. And so many times what people are really weighing in the last minutes are, okay, what is more important to me? My concerns about social issues or my pocketbook? And what I think you saw this time, because of how negative the campaign was, many people, even though they're concerned about their pocketbooks, went more towards their social concerns because it encompassed economic issues.
Well, right, and that's what got the media play, by the way, or that's what was covered.
Yeah. Right.
But overwhelmingly, what you heard about at every level, in every state, in every race, was the social issues.
Yes. There's that great quote by George Gallup, Gallup polls, when he was asked about how to measure independent voters. He said, well, when people are talking about independence, they lie, but they lie consistently.
Why do you think the Post Standard failed to choose a candidate or their selection for the presidency?
They abrogated their responsibility and as a newspaper, and they've given up.
Well, they don't. They're under no obligation to endorse anybody. They do endorsements. Not all newspapers make endorsements. My hometown paper does not. I frankly thought, I read the editorial where they declined to make any endorsement for the presidency, and I thought it was, I didn't buy it. B, I found it unpersuasive and oddly apologetic. But I didn't write it. Let's ask somebody if there were somebody.
Do you want to say something to that, Brad? No.
It was a lively discussion.
Well, sometimes,
I'm sure it was.
Sometimes the product of a committee is not the most artful product.
And I don't know if this still holds true, but I'll interject that several years ago when the Citizens League did a study on political participation and looked at studies of newspaper endorsements, found, no effect on, no significant effect on elections. I don't know if that still holds true or if it's consistent, but anyway.
Given the state of the economy and the fact that, you know, from the beginning of this race, that I think it was general consensus that if the economy was the deciding issue, that Romney was ahead, and he was ahead in all the polls with regard to what people thought he would be able to do to turn things around. And we always hear it's the economy, stupid. But what do you think the economy had, the role that it had, particularly with regard to the trends that we've been seeing with regard to that? I think Obama was successful in showing that it actually has been getting better, and also particularly the jobs, the jobs information that came out right before the election that was better than expected. Didn't work for Romney? It was the economy in the end, and Obama ended up on top.
It definitely was the economy. Mm-hmm. It was this, and you saw this in the exit polls, that people said that they're the slight economic, optimism. And the reason it was the economy and the reason it had such an effect is because at the beginning of Obama's term, things were so bad. They were worse than almost everyone has ever seen in their lifetimes. And so by comparison, 125,000 new jobs, even though the unemployment rate actually went up to 7.9, and we all know that it's not 7.9, right? We know that it's at least twice that in reality.
They turned that around into sort of
good news. Right. That's right. But the point is, any glimmer of hope was inordinately, disproportionately influential.
Right. Don't change horses in the middle of a raging stream. And that was really what this forward was all about. And what the last ads of Obama in his last two national ad buys were particularly influential in terms of making people forget where the economy was and think about where it was going. There was also two releases of national numbers that showed that there was some bump in the jobs, and Obama's numbers slightly went up with that. But let's also step back and say that the Republican candidate, Mr. Romney, was particularly ill-suited given his background.
That's right.
and given his position in life to take advantage of a bad economic situation, when because of his background and his situation in life, he was being presented as part of the 1% problem.
The economy is always a baseline factor in explaining elections. We know that to be the case. The Republican narrative was that the economy has not gotten better and that Obama's policies were a failure. But if you look at the trend lines across these past 4 years, the thing sort of bottomed out in the first 6 months of Obama's presidency. But the trend line has been up, even if at a slighter angle. And unemployment, by the way, is not a particularly good predictor of electoral outcomes.
Right.
Among various economic measures, it is not that important. That doesn't mean unemployment doesn't matter. But in terms of predicting electoral outcomes, there are many economic indicators that are much more important. The stock market is doing tons better than it was doing 3 years ago. Housing starts are up, manufacturing is up, consumer spending is up. And so the trend lines were in Obama's favor. They just haven't gotten us back to where the economy, where everybody wants the economy to be. And in particular, in swing states like Ohio, Virginia, and Iowa, the economies in those states were doing better than the national averages. And that's a key reason
that's
why
important.
Obama was leading in those swing states when usually they're right on the edge of what the national norm is, right? Because that's why those states
but
are
ironically,
swing states.
Obama did a great job of temporally. He dissociated himself from, you know, so the day he was sworn in to the present, he doesn't want to count the first 2 or 3 months after he was sworn in for purposes of jobs, because we lost millions and millions of jobs in that period of time. But he did want to count the fact that from the, where the stock market was the day he was sworn in till now.
Yeah.
So he managed to either count or not count those first couple months, and he did it effectively, and Romney didn't counter it.
The flip side of that is nationaljournal.com, which I follow faithfully and I recommend to you as being very unbiased in its reporting, had a little blurb this morning. It said, here's the election in a nutshell. So I clicked on it immediately, and it said, Romney is now resting from the campaign travails, .. on his own private yacht. And the implication of what Romney brought to the table in a time of economic crisis was obvious.
As a result of the presidential election, can you comment on the future of the Supreme Court?
Wow. Well, there may only be one justice who retires. It may be the case. I mean, we never know, obviously, mm-hmm. right? But I think we can be fairly, I mean, the likeliest justice to retire would be Justice Ginsburg. And so Obama would have the chance to replace her, which would have presumably no impact on the
right.
makeup of the Supreme Court. The issue is, if a second justice retires, assuming Ginsburg does retire, from which side of the aisle that justice will come, and you know, that's just a complete, we can't begin to predict that.
I guess I would only add to that, what gender? Because there's this belief that Ginsburg's holding now a woman's seat on the court. Will Obama put on a moderate to left-leaning woman from a district court?
Of course, he's nominated two women, so I
right.
think that gives him some flexibility in terms of possible right. pressure for women's groups. But
I have to say, before we leave the subject of women, it's remarkable. We're going to have 1/5 of the United States Senate, and it's going to be occupied by women.
Yeah.
And for the first time, I believe New Hampshire has a complete set of a woman governor and two woman senators.
And representatives in the House.
In the House.
You know, red, blue, electoral, popular vote, it always gets down to those swing states. And I think, you know, I'm a little let down sometimes. I feel almost like my vote doesn't count because of the electoral vote. You know, it's like, it's just those states that matter and the rest of us don't count. Can you respond to that, you know?
Your vote counted, Liz. How did you vote?
I, the chief culprit is the Electoral College.
Right.
I have a colleague at Cortland who has written extensively on the subject, and she defends the Electoral College. I think it is an absurd anachronism. There is no good argument for keeping the Electoral College. That doesn't mean we should simply replace it with nothing, I think. On the other hand, there's not going to be any change soon. I mean, it's been commented often that what we were really doing was electing the president of Ohio, and it sure felt that way. I do think it does a disservice to the electorate of the United States. And of course, the candidates calibrate their strategies, as you would expect them to winning the electoral vote, because the Constitution says that's how you choose a president. And that is one area where I think Obama's campaign was very, very smart in terms of how they structured that, because those are the rules of the game. But it's the Electoral College, and I think it's an absurdity.
Yeah, I agree with Bob wholeheartedly. The Electoral College should go, but it won't.
Yeah, that's correct.
The last campaign where a presidential candidate said that he was going to campaign, publicly announced he was going to campaign in all 50 states, was in 1960 with Richard Nixon. And it turned out to be an incredibly close race, and you want to talk about wasted time. On the night before the election, to honor his commitment, Nixon had to find a way to fly up to Alaska and then go from Alaska to Ohio and Illinois, where the votes really mattered. And there are observers, Teddy White was the first to point this out, and I think it sticks, that was what ended up costing Nixon Illinois in the long run, not dead people and not Daley, but his decision to have to go up and campaign in Alaska. If we did away with the Electoral College, the one thing that would happen is that these campaigns would have to become even more expensive, because you would have to go and campaign in Idaho. and you would have to do an ad buy in Idaho. You'd have to find a way to get
there. Why? There's only six people in the whole state.
Yeah, but you but you would have to go and spread spread your votes around.
They count the moose out there.
And think about this, Liz, we'd get a lot more television commercials here. So be careful what you wish for.
That's what we need is more television commercials.
Well, now that the election is over, we have about a month and a half, which is very critical. What do you think will happen in the lame duck Senate and otherwise with respect to the Bush tax cuts and all that sort of thing?
The fiscal cliff.
The fiscal cliff.
Fiscal cliff.
Yes.
Is the lame duck Congress going to jump in, or are they going to pass the ball?
My theory is that they're going to at least begin the talks. I think both sides recognize that this election, if there's any sort of mandate, it's from the public that we don't want to go where we've already been in terms of getting to the very edge, you know, ratings being reduced, et cetera. So I think the talks will begin. And, you know, then there's that hopeful part of me that hopes that they will at least do enough talking so that they have the basis of a plan before the election. I certainly think that's what the American people want. And certainly if the Republicans have any hope of, you know, turning things around in 2016, I think it's on them to, you know, show some willingness. Not that the president shouldn't compromise, but I think if they want their party to do better in 2016, they're going to have to really begin to show, okay, we're willing to really negotiate with the Democrats and with the president.
In a game of financial chicken, neither side has a mandate. You can't say that President Obama has the will of the people behind him to call the bluff on Capitol Hill right now, and the Republican Party is completely leaderless.
Why can't you say that?
Because I think Obama has an opportunity.
He has an opportunity, but I think he would be politically crazy that right now, because there's going to be pushback on Capitol Hill. This is a really tough question because somebody, in terms of pushing the fiscal cliff, you know, there's going to be an awful lot of blowback until after the inauguration. I disagree. I wish Tara was right, but I don't think she is. I don't think anything's going to be done with this of any substance until after the inauguration.
And he has the opportunity to put the Republican Congress in a box, right? He can let us go off the fiscal cliff and get the Senate, you know, work hard with the Senate to get a bill that then reduces tax rates on people earning less than $250,000, and then that goes to the House to see what they'll do with that.
He's not running again.
Time for one more quick question.
So, as the representative of Planned Parenthood in the room, I would argue, and I realize I may be biased, that 18-point difference with the women's vote had a lot to do with the attacks on Planned Parenthood. Would you comment?
No, you're talking about at the presidential level that Obama did 18 percentage points better among women than Romney did. Let's note first that there's been a gender gap between the parties dating back to about the 1980 presidential election. It has varied over time, but there's been a gap in every presidential election between voting behavior of women versus men in Democratic versus Republican candidates for president. But I think you're right that it had a mobilizing effect for many women, inspiring them to come to the polls. Women, of course, are divided on issues related to abortion and contraception and many other things, but surely it's an issue that did help the Democrats among women constituencies, yeah.
I also think what helped the Democrats is the fact that Romney showed very little leadership in responding to these issues in his party. And Lisa alluded to that earlier. Unfortunately, his colleagues gave him numerous opportunities for him to show some real leadership. And even if he didn't, you know, even if he couldn't go completely to the pro-choice side, he could have still addressed the issues and responded in a way that showed some empathy and some understanding that contraception is not just about, you know, a woman's right to choose. It's also an economic issue for many women. And he showed no leadership in that area. So in a way, he hurt himself.
I'd respond two ways. First of all, Todd Akin was a great gift to the Democratic Party.
Him and Murdoch.
Right,
yeah,
and Murdoch.
And but Claire McCaskill in particular.
Yes. But, yeah. But, to,
oh
but secondly, in terms of the way that it ended up going down, I think that you have to take a look at how the balance of power was with women in the first place. And it was going to be to the effect of the Democratic Party. and the question was whether or not it was going to be kept that way. Representative Ryan, for example, strongly pro-choice, but when Governor Romney decided that he was going to become
Ryan,
I'm sorry,
pro-life.
I'm sorry, pro-life. And when Romney did this flip-flop in the first debate, Ryan could no, it was taken out of Ryan's hands. He could no longer be that strongly pro-life. And you could tell in his speeches that it was grating at him, that he couldn't be as conservative as he wanted to be, because the Romney campaign, you could tell, was pulling Ryan back.
Yep. Yes, they did.
Okay. Well, Bob Spitzer, Tara Ross, Bob Green, Lisa Dolak, thank you once again for a great presentation.